And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70 celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg, joined as always in Zoom conference by the Athletics Mets beat writer Tim Britton. Tim, we've come to the end of the first half and the start of the second, and we didn't really do a lot of, we didn't think about, talk about first half awards for these 2021 Mets, and I think there's a pretty good reason for that.
Who would you say was the Mets' best player in the first half? Like the team MVP or something?
Yeah, I would go with MVP Jacob DeGrom. Most improved player, somehow also Jacob DeGrom. Best pitcher, Jacob DeGrom. Best hitter, maybe Jacob DeGrom. And unsung hero, probably still Jacob DeGrom, right? Unless you want to give a little love, which you could, to Aaron Loop, who has had a really nice season, very much under the radar.
I feel like Aaron Loop embodies more of the unsung part of that than the hero part of it, which is more DeGrom.
I don't think we're singing it. So people, we do sing about Jacob DeGrom, but are we singing enough?
That's true. I mean, Loop.
Like, it is still unsung.
Loop's FIP, which is a wonderful start to any sentence to say those two words back to back. Loop's FIP is 1.49, which is not that far behind Jacob DeGrom's 1.23. The difference, though, is that Jacob DeGrom has thrown 64 more innings over the course of the season so far. So I still think it's probably his award to lose.
Yeah. So that wraps up the Mets' first half awards. Best position player, Francisco Lindor, I guess, right? Like, it's just, and we'll talk about this with a question a little bit later in the show. It feels like just about every guy on the offensive side of things has done either significantly less than one might hope or slightly less than one might hope.
Yeah, I think like one of the ideas going into a second half podcast, you know, I like playing over under. And we've got a first half here. We can take every guy's OPS and be like, is it going to be better or worse in the second half? And I think, like, I don't know that there's a guy on the Mets that you would say would be worse in the second half. You know, like Billy McKinney, maybe, but I'm not sure how long he'll be on the roster with some guys coming back. You know, maybe Brandon Nimmo, 841 OPS, or J.D. Davis is over 1,000 because he's only played in 14 games. And he's coming back this weekend. But really, it's not a hard game to play for so many of these guys. You would expect, you know, obviously a better than 646 OPS for Michael Conforto or 690 for Jeff McNeil or 691 for James McCann or 702 for Francisco Lindor, the 710 for Dom Smith. They're all in that 650 to 710 range, really. And you'd expect most of these guys to be up closer to 770 to 800 to 850. I think in general, the expectation is that, you know, the Mets' record might not be a whole lot better in the second half, but I would expect the offense to be a lot better and the pitching to regress a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of position players who have exceeded expectations, including like and considering playing time as well, because Nimmo and Davis, the stats look great, but they it's hard to say they've exceeded expectations because they've missed most of the season. So the position players that have exceeded expectations, I would say, are Billy McKinney, Luis Guillorme, Tomas Nito, and maybe Jonathan Villar.
Yeah, you know, Villar for a time before he got hurt was right up there with Lindor as the leader in Fangraph's wins above replacement for them among position players, which was not how you sketch it out at the start of the year. And I think you've seen as the season has gone on, you know, with guys like VR and Kevin Pillar and Jose Peraza, who we've talked about a bit of late, like, they get exposed a bit. You know, it doesn't feel, for instance, like Kevin Pillar's slash line is 218, 256, 389. He's got a 645 OPS. It feels like he's done more than that, but that is kind of where it's at. And Peraza certainly has felt like he's done more than what his slash line represents, because all of his hits win games.
Yeah, I would say, I guess it's a, the Mets offense has a sunny future, or like there's some possibility that whatever environmental factors are at play this season, and it's so hard to know because there's just so many things going on. Like, I've been thinking about it. Has there been, like, since the dawn of the live ball era in 1920, has there been a period of more, like, more dramatic flux in the conditions of the baseball environment, like beyond, and that's not even to consider the COVID and all of the accommodations that teams have made for that, but incorporating humidors in some stadiums, changing the ball perhaps multiple times, and now the whole sticky stuff things. It feels like it's probably hard for all of the systems, like, you know, that do park factors and adjustments to league averages, to fully get a grasp of everything that's handling it. So I'd say that to me, it's like 90% likely that the Mets have just underperformed offensively and overperformed as a pitching staff. But there's also like that 10% chance that this is right exactly what we might have expected if we knew everything there is to know about what's going on with baseball right now.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, people have called this like year of the pitcher 2.0, going back to, you know, 1968 as being the other one. But you forget that, like, I believe it was 2012 was also considered a year of the pitcher. That was when Ubaldo Jimenez had like a 0.9 ERA through 14 starts or something, and was basically the best start to a season before DeGrom this year in a long time. And then you had for a time there in 2012, 2013, 2014, offense was considerably down from where it had been, obviously, in the steroid era, and even in like the late 2000, the late first decade of the two, what do we call that? The aughts? The late aughts.
The aughts.
You know, you had teams like the Royals and Giants in the 2014 World Series. The Royals hit like two home runs in a 7-game World Series and almost won. They finished one run shy of winning it. And the Giants did, you know, they didn't hit home runs either. And then they won three World Series in there. So you had like a very different game then, and then the second half of the 2015 season is when the home runs started to come around. You had like the it seemed like the 2017 World Series with the Dodgers and Astros would be the apex of all of these home runs, that crazy 13-12 game, like teams just knocking 3-run home runs in every half inning. And then 2018, it like comes back down a bit, the offense, because the ball seems to be like fixed or something, and then 2019 it explodes again. So it's really been just, it's like a tennis match going back and forth with your head swinging back on a swivel with how offense has played over the last 10 years. And it's been hard to just know going, like, how good is an 800 OPS going to be for a guy? How good is a 280 average, 360 on base kind of season for someone? Because the slugging numbers have changed so much. You know, we've gone from like years where, you know, Francisco Lindor would hit 38 home runs. Like, I watched that happen, and it still seems weird. Like, I think he's an incredibly good baseball player. It's still weird he hit 38 home runs. It's still weird Jose Ramirez hit as many home runs as he did, or Rougned Odor, or like Freddie Galvis had a 20 homer season. Like, guys, you're used to being like, yeah, they're good middle infielders who can hit a bit. You don't expect them to be hitting that many home runs.
Yeah, it's been a very strange period in the history of Major League Baseball. And I think it's a great call at saying that 2017 World Series is sort of, it feels like sort of the apex of like a lot of things that have been going on in recent years. Like, that's like, and also not for nothing, because a lot of people have I think dismissed it entirely because the Astros won, and we know the Astros were banging on garbage cans. That was a spectacularly good World Series. Like, that was one of the best in my book. And that Game 5 that you referenced was, I think, the best, probably the best baseball game I've ever seen, regardless of whether people were banging on garbage cans. It was just incredible. And, you know, that's part of the story now. But it's not about the Mets. There is a little bit of news. You referenced Shady Davis coming back, but perhaps to in a position of more dire need, you bore witness to one possible solution.
Yeah, so we're recording this on Friday morning. I was in Brooklyn on Thursday night to watch Carlos Carrasco's first two innings of competitive baseball as a member of the New York Mets. He was pitching against a different uniform. And he looked pretty good. He threw 27 pitches. You know, his command wasn't like A-plus command. He pulled some fastballs. It's what I think was his curveball. It might have been a slower slider. Looked a little loopy at times, but he also got a swing and miss on that and a swing and miss on what looked like a more traditional slider and a changeup and his fastball. So he looked like, you know, it was better than you'd expect for a guy who hasn't pitched a real inning since 2020. It's not like he's a start away from being major league ready in my mind. You know, I think it's debatable whether the strategy the Mets are talking about of having him kind of flesh out his rehab and strength building with his arm can take place at the major league level, where, you know, maybe he makes a couple more rehab starts of 3 and 4 innings, and then he can pitch, you know, 4 in his first major league start and not be fully stretched out. I don't love that idea. But I'm willing to be converted to it if his next couple rehab starts go well.
What is it that you don't love about that idea?
Because, you know, you want someone to have kind of a linear progression like they do in spring training. And Carrasco didn't have a spring training. Like, I think if we were talking about someone who had gone through everything in spring training, like, let's say Carlos Carrasco had his spring training, was ready to start the season, and then in his first start of the major league season hurt his hamstring and has been out since then. I think it's probably a different story because he'd been built up totally. But, you know, you get into a major league game, it's a totally different environment than what you're pitching in high A or triple A. It's less controllable for you as a pitcher. The adrenaline is there. And if you're trying to build him up and say that first start, he gets hit hard in the first inning and he's throwing 30 pitches, you've got to pull him. And that sets him back in terms of that progression. It sets you back in terms of where you are competitively as a team. So I like, you know, we've seen with like Brandon Nimmo and JD Davis why they needed to go through the rehab assignments to feel good again. You know, I think it's tempting to say, like, well, you know, if they're able to play at AAA, they should be able to play in the majors. But a large part of the rehab assignment is finding out if they're able to play even at AAA. And we've seen when guys have come back a little sooner, they've struggled a bit more to make the adjustment back to the majors. You know, Michael Conforto had a short rehab assignment and did not and has not hit the ground running back in the major leagues. So I think especially with a guy like Carrasco, who hasn't pitched much at all this year, I'd rather play it conservative with him. And really, the only reason you're talking about having him come back in the major leagues before that's done is because you have so few other options.
You know, that's a series of good points, and yet I'm still like, hey, well, if he's healthy enough to play in AAA, he should be able to play in the major leagues. I feel like they just need innings, you know, and he's going to pitch them somewhere. I get the controlled environment thing. I think that's correct, but I think, you know, we've also certainly heard of teams having guys throw extra in the bullpen after their short starts when they're in that process of stretching out. I don't hate it. I don't know. I feel like the Mets are. This doesn't feel like a season where you're gonna necessarily be conservative. And like, I hate to say that for Carrasco's sake, because he's got another season potentially under contract with the team, and he's got a career ahead of him. You don't want to say, oh, you can play it loose with this guy. But, you know, it's a club that I think has played a little bit, or at least it's played under its head in many ways, but I think has the record is better than where they deserve to be. The standings there, the position they are in the standings in first, and a few games out in front is perhaps a little ahead of where they deserve to be based on their first half play. I feel like you got to do what you can to put the pedal on the metal now. And if that's letting Carlos Carrasco be the first head in your bullpen game for a couple turns. I don't know. I don't hate it.
Well, it's interesting to think about how kind of the landscape of the division impacts that decision too. Because clearly, you know, if the Mets, let's imagine a world where their entire offense doesn't get hurt for the month of May, and they're 8 games up in the division rather than 4. And you have a Braves team that just lost Ronald Acuna Jr. not trading for Jock Peterson in that instance. And you have teams in Philadelphia and Washington that are less likely to actually try to buy at the trade deadline. Then you can pretty easily take your time with Carrasco, because your thought is, you know, this is a guy that we are building up to October. That is what is in mind. We're not worried about who's starting a game for us on July 29th. We're worried about who's starting game 4 of a division series. But because it's still relatively tight in the NL East, with some like very flawed teams behind them, you know, Atlanta, I don't think we've talked about the loss of Acuna and what that does to like the team they can be. Because to me, the Braves have been the biggest threat to the Mets in the division all season. Mm-hmm. You know, they are the 3-time defending division champions. They're the best team on paper of those ones chasing New York. And now they've lost Acuna. Their outfield is a mess. You know, I don't think anyone expects Marcell Ozuna back at any point this season. Mike Soroka's out for the season. Like, Ian Anderson's going on the IL. There's really nothing there that makes you think that team is capable of going on a run in the second half to overtake you, unless they make the kind of big trade deadline move that organization hasn't made in a really long time. And that even when they've been good the last few years, they've made kind of smaller around the margin trade deadline moves. So I certainly don't expect them to do that now. You know, both the Phillies and Nationals are in spots where, you know, like Chris Bryant makes a lot of sense for both of those teams, just, you know, what their strengths and weaknesses are, but also are they good enough to go in on a move like that, you know? Or is that kind of wasting their limited prospect resources chasing a team that, you know, they're under 500 at this point? And so I wonder if the Mets, you know, by the time, let's say they're gearing Carrasco up, that was July 15th was his first rehab, maybe the 20th would be the next, the 25th after that, and saying, okay, maybe by July 30th, he can be our starter for the back in black Friday night game against Cincinnati. Maybe if by that point the lead is 6 or 7 in the division, maybe if the Phillies and Nationals, you know, that is the night of the trade deadline, maybe if they're not making the big moves, maybe if the Braves haven't made a big splash in the trade market, then you say, you know what, we feel good about where we are in the division. Let's start thinking more about October, which is obviously a very dangerous thing for any Mets organization to think about, but should be part of the calculation in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, I don't want to say I'm glad you brought up Acuna, but it is, it's good you brought up Acuna, just because it really can't be overstated, I think, how devastating that is to the Braves. Also, I mean, just to the quality of Major League Baseball, like, as someone who has really despised that team for such a long time, that guy rules. And, you know, what a shame that he won't be part of any sort of pennant race in the NL East this year. But definitely something that bodes, I think, much better for the Mets than, you know, than it did a couple weeks ago. Just this is a viable MVP candidate, undoubtedly the best position player. And it's no disrespect to Freddie Freeman, who's really good, but Acuna's having a better season. He's a more dynamic player. He's a more valuable defender. He is one of the best players in the world. So losing him is, I think, to me, that kind of takes the Braves from that position where you said as the most legitimate threat to maybe a threat, but like Jock Peterson isn't gonna make up that difference. And with no disrespect to him, it's not Acuna. And so now I don't even know. Like I guess it's the Phillies, right? Like, but I don't know how afraid you need to be of the Phillies. This sounds like a foolish amount of confidence to be speaking with in the middle of July. And so I just want to move on before we say that no one's going to catch the Mets.
Well, I was going to say to argue against myself, you know, you see the Acuna injury for Atlanta, and, you know, we've had so many injuries in the sport so far this year, and some serious ones. The Mets clearly know that well themselves. And we went through their first half awards and gave them exclusively to one man. And if you are the Braves, Nationals, or Phillies, you can say to yourself, you know, if Jacob deGrom goes down for any amount of time, the Mets are clearly a very different team without him. Even when he missed just a little bit of time on the injured list earlier this season, that was a real scramble for the Mets and their pitching staff. And that was when kind of more guys were held. That's when they had David Peterson and Joey Lucchesi in their rotation. So you can say to yourself, as a team chasing the Mets, like, you know, they're also one bad injury away from being in the same spot we're in. So we shouldn't necessarily give up with 2.5 months left.
Bite your tongue, Tim Britton. Let's never speak of that again.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
The Mets drafted Kumar Rocker, one of the two guys in the draft that I had heard of.
Yeah, you know, him and his teammate Jack Leiter were the guys that everyone knew. And Rocker, I think, you know, coming into the spring college baseball season,
he was the only guy I had heard of. I didn't find out about Jack Leiter until like the middle of the season. Kumar Rocker was like the single college baseball player I was aware of entering the season. And now he's on the Mets.
Yeah, I think the thought was he was going to be a top two or three pick at that point, maybe the favorite to go first overall. And, you know, pitchers don't generally go first overall. You kind of tend to go with position players there. But even as late as, like, I think 2 days before the draft, you know, Keith Law at The Athletic had a mock draft that had the Rangers taking Kumar Rocker second overall. And instead, he fell all the way to 10th to the Mets. Major League Baseball draft is weird in that those kinds of things happen more often in the baseball draft than they do in like the NBA draft or the NFL draft because of kind of how teams have figured out how to use their slot money. So you had the Tigers, for instance, the Royals and the Orioles ahead of the Mets kind of go with under slot first round guys, which kind of kept Rocker out of the picture for them. Once Kansas City didn't take him at number 7, it looked like it would get to the Mets at 10. I was surprised the Angels took a college pitcher who was not Kumar Rocker. Didn't seem to make a lot of sense from their perspective. But it's a kind of, you know, more or less a coup for the Mets in the draft to get a talent of that level at the 10th pick, a guy who is, you know, also fills a major weakness for them in the farm system as a frontline starting pitching prospect. They don't have a lot of those. The ones they do are either in the midst of recovering from Tommy John, have just come back from Tommy John surgery, like JT Ginn, or are going through the rehab process now, like Matt Allen. So Rocker kind of slots in there, I think, as probably a top 5 Mets prospect and probably their best pitching prospect, given that Allen is coming off the surgery and really fortifies that area for him.
And I think probably he's an exciting prospect in some ways when you consider that Ronnie Mauricio and Francisco Alvarez, the other biggest prospects in the system are A-ball players and guys who are a little bit younger than Rocker. And so you have to assume a little bit further away. This is a guy with 3 years of experience at arguably the top baseball program in the country, a very, very professional operation at Vanderbilt. And so I think, is it reasonable for me to hope that, like, we see Kumar Rocker sometime before, you know, maybe by the start of 2023?
Yeah, I think that's not unreasonable. I would not expect to see him do a whole lot this year. I know there were some Mets fans who were like, he can be the boost to the starting rotation right away. And I don't know of an example of a guy getting drafted and then starting games for a team. This season he was drafted. I think Chris Sale appeared in relief a bit. So did Garrett Crochet last year for the White Sox. But you know, it's
did
committed.
Mike Leake? I know Mike Leake skipped the minors, but did he do it?
He might, yeah, that might work. Mike Leake.
I don't know if it was the year he was drafted or if it was the year after he was drafted, though.
But with Rocker, you know, he threw 122 innings with Vanderbilt. That would, I believe, that would lead not that would lead the Mets. I wonder, would that lead the major leagues right now in terms of how many innings he's thrown so far this year? It would. He has thrown more innings this season than any pitcher in Major League Baseball has. Zach Wheeler's at 119 and two-thirds. So I think I would not expect the Mets to push him hard in the minor league season. The draft is already later than usual. It's a month later than usual this year. So you have less minor league season to go. So I would just not expect, you know, he might make a start or two at the end of the year, but I would think that would be it. And then get into instruction in the, you know, fall instructional league and all that stuff before hitting the ground running next year. And I think he could be a guy who starts in A-ball next year, but moves relatively fast and could be an option by, you know, this time next year down the stretch of 2022 and then into 2023.
I am psyched about it again, because he's the guy I've heard of. He better not be someone I hate in 2 years. As so often happens with the best prospects. I'm kidding. I don't hate them. Other people do. We have a good question, but we also have a good Mets question. We also have a good life question. Someone wanted to know, specifically someone wanted to ask me what episode it was where we gave book recommendations. I didn't look back to figure it out. So I figured this might be a good opportunity for a fresh book recommendation. Do you have one?
Do I have to give I don't remember what I said last time, and I'm afraid I'm going to give the same ones.
You gave a bunch. You gave a bunch. I remember I said there was some Ted Chiang in there.
Yes, yeah, that's been one of my go-to fiction recommendations. Let me pull up. You know, I thought about rereading this recently, and I haven't yet, but a book called Who Killed Palomino Molero by Mario Vargas Llosa. Is just a very short, like 150 page kind of thing that I remember really liking. Read it in like 2017 or 2018. That one was really good. I forget if I might have mentioned this last time. A classic that I recently got to and enjoyed more than I expected was The Red and the Black by Stendhal. That's a book that I feel like gets overlooked most times. Like, it's the kind of book you would read in school, but almost no one does read it in school. Mm-hmm. I didn't. I mean, I had it on my shelf for like 15 years and finally decided, like, oh, let's give this a shot. And it was quite good.
I recently read, this is like pretty far from my normal, something I might normally read, a book called No One Is Talking About This by Patricia Lockwood. It's like almost as much, I mean, it's not fully clear that you would call it fiction. It's categorized as fiction. It sounds like a whole lot of it is drawn on her real life and reality, and it's got elements of it that are like almost as much a prose poem of sorts as a novel. But it is, it was like a I thought breathtakingly insightful look, specifically like she didn't say Twitter. She's clearly talking about Twitter, and for anyone who has spent too much time on Twitter, it will make you think in like new and concerning and interesting ways about that medium and that website. And then on top of it, it just has this, there's like this sort of like beautiful human story to the book as well. I heartily recommend it. It was a real short book as well. So, it takes you like 8 hours to read, and we'll probably save you that amount of time, certainly I found, in how much it keeps you off Twitter.
Yeah, that is always the goal of, like, that's my New Year's resolution. It's my second half of the season resolution. It's just, like, maybe not have it open all the time. Maybe not while Ted is giving his book recommendation, be scrolling through Twitter and seeing what people are saying already. You know, it's just...
I mean, I'll say that I finished the book, and I was like, I gotta follow Slade on Twitter. It's like, that's my first move. I finished the book. I was like, this is an incredible book. I just wonder if she's on Twitter. And then went and followed her. And sure enough, she's on there and pretty good.
Yeah, it is rare, like the public figure that you follow on Twitter and like more for doing so. I feel like in general, like you follow comedians or actors or any kind of celebrity authors, and you're just like, oh, like this is, you're a bit more mundane than I expected. I thought everything was going to hit, and it doesn't.
I would say the book is like almost frustratingly wise. You're like, why couldn't I have seen the world this way before I read this book? It was so good. It really blew me away. A question on the Mets from my childhood neighbor, Pat, who has emailed us before. He wants to know, he says, is it reasonable to expect Conforto, Lindor, and McNeil to progress to their offensive means in the second half? If so, is there an estimated WAR that those three players can bring if they become the offensive players we expected them to be? He says, anecdotally, it feels like if these guys get hot, we should be able to win 92-plus games rather than the 88 Mets are on pace for now. Is there a way to quantify that? And you can give me a lot more here, but I would say I think regression or progression or reversion to the mean is certainly factored into the major projection systems on the Mets. And we talked at the top of the show all about the many Mets players underperforming on the offensive side and the guys sort of overperforming on the pitching side. You can't hope for the return to the mean from the hitters without considering that the pitchers do the same thing. I also think if you look at those systems, they mostly say 88, 89 wins for the Mets. That is a reflection of those systems' belief that the Mets will play better for the second half, even though it's not far from their regular pace. It's that their run differential right now is plus +9. They have not played as a team that should be 7 games over .500. And so the projection system sort of expect that they are as good as their current record because their current record is a little bit better than one might expect given their performance in the first half.
Yeah, I'm looking here at Baseball Prospectus has them, you know, at 89 wins, a .549 win percentage the rest of the way, which is better than the .540 they've posted. FanGraphs has them with a .557 rest of season win percentage that would get them through there. Both of them have them with playoff odds over 75%, 76.6 on Prospectus, 77.2 on FanGraphs. I mean, I think you can say in general that the offense should be better because, you know, if A, it's just healthier, so you're giving fewer at-bats to, you know, you look on the baseball reference page for the Mets, you're giving fewer at-bats to guys like Brandon Drury, Mason Williams, Cameron Maben, you know, Jhenashree Fargas, Khalil Lee, and then also the Pilar, Peraza, McKinney, Guillorme range, the guys who have done well, who have filled in quite well. But who are not, you know, their projected ceiling is not the same as it is for the guys who are coming back from the injured list, especially offensively. I don't know that you can say I feel confident in saying that like Michael Conforto will have a better than .646 OPS or Dominic Smith will be better than a .710. But you know, when you're talking about like six different guys you expect to be better, the likelihood is that at least one of them isn't, you know, that someone is going to, that this is just what they are this year, whether that is, you know, a James McCann or Jeff McNeil or a Lindor or Conforto, like that someone's just going to have a down year. And even like you have to realize with these guys, the end of the season numbers aren't going to be nice and shiny. You know, Conforto is not going to hit 30 home runs. He's got 3 right now. You know, I think players have to come to terms with what their numbers are going to look like at the end of the year, even if they perform well in the second half. And fans will have to recognize improvement even when the overall numbers don't look really good. Like if Conforto gets to a 100 OPS plus from his current 84, like that's going to take a lot of work. He's going to have a pretty good second half and it's still going to look like a relatively pedestrian year and a down year for him. So that's kind of how you've got to keep that in perspective. But I think in general, yes, you can say that the Mets should score more runs than multiple teams in Major League Baseball rather than the one team they've scored more than so far this year, the team they're playing this weekend.
Yeah, that is a very good way of putting it. This offense may not be what we hoped it would be, but it's definitely better than what we've seen so far. And that seems like a good note to end on as the Mets begin second half play tonight in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, it's... Sorry, the sirens in your background are...
Yes, I am very much outside right now.
I was trying to make like a joke about the timing of that as you're saying the Mets offense is going to get better and we hear sirens.
Their cops are
but
coming
that's the
me.
Joke.
Yeah,
that's
the thought police. Yeah.
But yeah, you know, the second it will be an interesting one. The Mets are going to be buyers at the deadline for the first time in 5 years. They're in first place at the All-Star break. I think for the first time since 2007. Is it? I should probably know that.
Yeah.
So it's
what are you looking at me for?
It's setting up to be you know, as exciting a second half as this team has had in quite some time.
And we will, of course, be around to talk about it starting early next week. Tim, peace out.
Adios.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.